fence anymore. Hold on, babe, I'd say. I'm coming for you. I'd keep the pedal to the metal until I either arrived at her house or got pulled over. Son, do you know how fast you were going? The cop would say. I would set my jaw and look him squarely in the eye. With all due respect, sir, I would say, right now I think my girlfriend needs my warm embrace more than the Commonwealth of Virginia needs my money. The cop would see from my heroic expression that the only way to stop me would be to shoot me in the face. Then his hardened heart would melt in the light of my undying love. Follow me, he'd say. He would get in his car and escort me with lights flashing and sirens blazing. We'd blow stop signs and traffic lights. When I got to Evelyn's driveway, I'd skid sideways, the back of my car whipping into her garage door and knocking it off its hinges so I could get inside faster. I'd run inside through the now open garage and find her curled up in bed crying. At the sight of me, she would jump into my arms. Shh, it's okay. I'm here now, I'd say. And I would know from the tightness of her grip around my chest how much she needed me, and how the strength of my embrace was restoring her sense of well-being. She would feel better. I would feel needed. So how are you? Evelyn asked. I'm good. Yeah, really good. And guess what? What? Guess. Okay, she said. You made the U.S. ski team? No, 2 years away from that. Now that I was home from Colorado, I still went to school functions, like sporting events, senior proms, and the like, but I wasn't at school every day, so I didn't have access to the up-to-the-minute stats about who had a date and who didn't. That's partially why Evelyn was a good choice to be my date. She was from another school. I knew she was available. That and the fact that she was super hot. And she was my best friend. If there was anyone I could let loose with and have fun with on the dance floor, it would be her. Guess again. I give up. Okay. You ready for this? I don't know. Am I? I was nominated for prom king.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Josh, that's awesome. Congrats.
Thanks.
But you hate dances.
I know.
What are you gonna do?
Find a date, I guess, I replied. She chuckled. As a matter of fact, I willed myself to press on. I was wondering if you might possibly want to go with me. There was a horrendously long pause that lasted at least 1 full second. Finally, she said, I'd love to. I hoped she couldn't hear my sigh of relief. Great. It'll be fun.
I think so, too. I've never gone to a dance with a prom king, she said.
Neither have I. She laughed. Maybe it'll be a first for both of us, then. Maybe, but realistically, I probably won't win. I mean, I don't want to get your hopes up.
Of course you'll win, Josh Sundquist, but I'll go to prom with you either way.
Thanks. I appreciate your commitment. I gave her the details. A few of her friends from Spotswood High had boyfriends at Harrisonburg High. She suggested that we could get dinner with them before the dance. I had already thought of this, but I acted like I hadn't and agreed it was a stellar idea.
Call me again soon, she said.
I will, I promised.
I appreciate your commitment, she said.
I smiled. Bye.
See you.
Chapter 20. At dinner the next Monday, Dad revealed the complex prom compensation package he and Mom had devised in response to my pleas for financial assistance. We will pay for the tickets to the dance, he said, and half of dinner. You're on your own for the tuxedo rental. I knew this last part was a concession to my mom,
who bought all her clothes at thrift stores. She would think that I should just buy a black suit and a bow tie from Goodwill rather than rent a tux.
What about after prom? I asked.
After prom was the accurately but not creatively titled event that took place following the dance. It was basically a big G-rated party hosted by the parents where students could participate in quasi-fun activities that did not involve alcohol or pregnancy.
What about it? Asked Dad.
You're not going to pay for my tickets? They're only $10 each.
I believe you can afford that, said Dad.
You know, I said, lowering my voice slightly to convey gravity. Studies show that if a couple does not attend after prom, the girl is far more likely to end up getting...
Okay, okay, all right, he interrupted.
Luke and Anna were both pre-birds and bees talk, and Dad didn't want me saying the P word around them, which could lead to uncomfortable dinner table questions about the mechanics of reproduction.
We'll pay for your after prom tickets.
In that case, I guess I can get by without getting a job. Mom let out a sigh of relief.
If, said Dad.
Here it comes, I said.
You do the dishes tonight.
I smiled. Deal. Nice doing business with you. The next afternoon, I went to rent my tuxedo. I wasn't quite as frugal as my mom. That is, I didn't want to buy a tuxedo from the 70s at a thrift store, but neither did I want to drop three figures on a rental from an upscale tuxedo shop. I knew just the place to go. A super sad-looking wedding supply store on the first floor of a two-story house near my high school. The living room window had been converted into a display case featuring a creepy mannequin. Is there any other kind of mannequin? In a bridal gown, and a sign that read, Tuxedo Rental, $30. I knew a good deal when I saw one.
I'd like one of those $30 tuxedos, please.
Do you want the shoes, too?
Do they come with it?
No, they're 20 extra. I owned a pair of shoes. In fact, I owned several pairs of shoes. So I decided that there was no reason to spend an extra $20. After all, I was here to rent a tuxedo. That's the piece I didn't own.
No thanks, just the tux.
They had two sizes remaining. I chose the one that fit less worse. When I got home, Mom asked if I had ordered the corsage yet.
What's a corsage again? I asked.
The flowers. These days, it's usually an elastic band that goes around the girl's wrist.
Is that important?
Yes.
Well, no, I haven't.
I called around to the flower shops for you, she said. I found one that has them for only $6.
Oh, thanks. That sounds like a good deal.
Yes, and, well, she said as if she had something stuck in her throat. I would like to buy it for you, if you want. She smiled a smile that revealed both the pain of offering to pay $6 and her pleasure in giving me a gift that would enhance my chances with Evelyn.
Thanks, Mom, I said, hugging her.
You're welcome. Do you know what color Evelyn's dress is?
No. Why?
I need to tell the flower shop.
Why do they care?
So they can match the flowers with her dress.
Really?
Yes, really.
People care about that stuff?
Girls care about that stuff. I slept until 3:30 on the day of prom in order to be well rested for staying up all night. Unfortunately, this also meant I started the day behind schedule. I scrambled to take a shower, shave, and put on my tux. That last part turned out to be incredibly complicated, involving a highly inefficient and antiquated buttoning system down the front and French cuffs that required cufflinks, which are virtually impossible to put on if you have the unfortunate disadvantage of being born with only two hands. The only easy part was the bow tie, because it was of the pre-tied clip-on variety. Anyway, I was supposed to pick up Evelyn for dinner at 4:30, and I left approximately on time, but after driving a few miles, it hit me. I had forgotten the corsage. I wheeled around and drove back to my house, where my mom retrieved the corsage from the refrigerator. By the time I left again, it was already 4:30, and I still had at least a 15-minute drive to Evelyn's house. I was sweating profusely and breathing short, shallow breaths. This was such an important night, and here I was ruining it because I was late. I drove 85 in a 55, faster than I ever had before, on my way to her house. It was kind of like my fantasy about her, except instead of speeding heroically so I could comfort her sooner, I was driving frantically because I was having a mild panic attack. I skidded to a stop in front of her house and hobbled on my artificial leg up to the front porch. She answered on the first knock, literally right after my fist made contact with the door, so when my hand returned for a second knuckle wrap, the door was already opening, and I nearly punched Evelyn with a palm-forward fist. "Are you okay?" she asked.
"Yeah, why?" I said, breathing heavily.
"You look sweaty."
This isn't really what anyone, guy or girl, wants to hear upon being inspected in their formal attire by their prom date.
"It's really hot out."
"Is it?"
She extended her arm outside to feel the temperature.
"Yeah, I guess."
"I'm so sorry I'm late."
"No problem."
I looked at her for the first time. When you make your initial examination of the appearance of your female prom date, you must balance the competing obligation and desire to linger over the curves of her body long enough to appreciate the thought and care that went into her dress selection with the fact that her dad is standing in the foyer immediately behind her and he is looking at you looking at his daughter. I started with her feet, which were adorned casually in flip-flops. A nice choice, given the exceedingly non-prom-like wingtips I was wearing that matched the color of her dress. The dress was a long silver gown with a thin mesh netting over a base of silk. It started at her ankles and ended below her shoulders. Her hair was glued and glittered like some kind of complex decorative piece of pottery that would shatter if it was dropped. She looked beautiful. But I didn't want to just say that. "Hi there, you look beautiful." Because that was what I was expected to say. That's what all gentlemen say to their prom dates. Mom had taught me that. Even if she hadn't looked beautiful, I would have said it anyway. It was the appropriate remark for the occasion. Precisely because it was so appropriate, so perfunctory, however, I wanted to say something more so she would know she really did look absolutely beautiful. So she would know I noticed the way the elegantly shimmering dress matched her nails and the way it all radiated out from her big brown eyes like rays from the sun. But again, her dad was standing right there. "You look beautiful," I said, adding a slight but meaningful pause in between the second and third words.
"Thank you," she beamed.
"And you look very handsome."
Which I didn't, I knew. I looked very sweaty. But it was the polite thing to say, and Evelyn was a polite girl. She invited me in for the exchange of wearable flower arrangements, a ceremony her mother was already poised to photograph with paparazzi-like eagerness. I unwrapped the $6 corsage my mom had given me. It was blue and white. I slipped it over Evelyn's wrist, the flashbulb strobe lighting the room. Evelyn's mother produced a boutonniere and handed it to her. Evelyn removed the pin from the stem and stepped so close I could taste her perfume on my tongue. "I'll try not to stick you," she said. Similar to "you look beautiful," this is the obligatory line uttered by every human being who has ever installed a pin-attached flower arrangement to the lapel of another human being. It's not funny, particularly if yours is the epidermis in question, but you have to laugh anyway. We posed for a variety of other photos, and then we were off. I put a mix CD that did not include any of Annie DeFranco's work in the car stereo.
By way of making conversation, I said, "Have you decided about college yet?" She shook her head. "No. I was pretty set on Virginia Tech, but now with Mason and me being on a break, I'm not so sure."
"What do you mean?"
"Like, maybe I just wanted to go there to be with him."
I nodded. "Well, better to find that out now than go there, break up freshman year, and realize you had just followed him to school."
I wondered whether my words revealed too much glee over her partial singleness. "At the same time," she added, "I don't want to not go there just because he's there. I mean, maybe that's the best college for me, you know? I can't plan my entire life around avoiding him."
"True, true. No one likes a reverse stalker."
I wished silently that she had applied to William and Mary.
"Do you think you'll get back together?" I asked.
"No. I mean, yeah, probably. I don't know."
We were silent for a while, thinking.
I knew they would most likely get back together eventually. I mean, historically speaking, a definite pattern had emerged. So far, 100% of their previous breakups had resulted in passionate reunions, in getting back together agains. And as they say, history repeats itself. But right now, tonight, she was more or less single. If I ever had a chance, this was it. It all seemed to hang on whether I won Prom King. If I won, maybe that would give me the confidence boost I needed to be a fun dancing partner, and then to try to kiss her or tell her how I felt. And maybe it would help her think of me as more than a friend. If I was Prom King, I might become, in her eyes, something more. On the other hand, maybe she'd just be happy that her good friend, Josh Sundquist, had won a popularity contest. Maybe she thought of me like a brother, or maybe she valued our friendship too much to see if there was something more there. That was the problem. Back when I had been trying to date Francesca, the issue had been that I didn't have a friend to help me understand the relationship. The problem with Evelyn? She was the friend. It all came down to tonight. Chapter 21. Obviously, you want to go somewhere fancy to eat on the night of prom, which is why our group chose one of the classiest joints in Harrisonburg, an upscale seafood establishment called Red Lobster. There were six of us, three couples. After dinner, we went to one of the guys' houses for more photos. Prom is nothing more than a practice round, a dress rehearsal for your wedding, and in no arena is this fact on more prominent display than the number of photos taken leading up to the event. Sometimes you get the feeling that the photos are more important than the event itself. On the drive from the photo session to the school, Evelyn asked, "Do you think you'll win Prom King?" "Honestly, not really." "Well, I thought I had as good a chance as the other three guys, and I wanted to win, mainly to impress Evelyn, to sweep her off her feet with my popularity and esteem in the eyes of my fellow students. But relationships are all about managing expectations, you know?"
"I think you'll win," she stated.
"How come?"
"Because you're Josh Sundquist."
"That is my name, yes.
And Josh Sundquist is a winner."
I wasn't so sure, but I said, "Thanks for saying that."
"Seriously, you're gonna win."
She reached over and grabbed my hand, squeezed and released. It felt tingly and amazing. It felt like I was enough for her, like she liked me, like everyone in my class liked me and had voted for me. It felt like I was Prom King.
"I hope you're right," I said.
Once we finally got to the dance, we were forced to endure, for the sake of the parents and their all-important photographs, a long, boring ritual known as introductions. The introduction ceremony would conclude with the naming of the prom king and queen, which was great because it meant if I lost, not only would all my classmates know, all their parents would find out too. A crowd of nearly 1,000 would be on hand to witness my humiliation. After you were introduced with your date, the two of you had to walk down a portable staircase in front of center stage. It is exceedingly difficult to walk on stairs with a hip dysarthric level prosthesis without a handrail, as was the case here. To make matters worse, Evelyn would have her arm hooked around my elbow, so her descent could easily knock me off balance. As I stood there in line awaiting our turn, I thought of this experience I'd had when I was a freshman. I was still fresh off the boat from homeschooling, nervous about navigating the halls of the school on my artificial leg. One day, as I was about to head down a flight of stairs, this upperclassman I sort of knew from one of my classes walked up beside me. She was flirty and pretty. I remember she seemed so much older. As I took my first step down the stairs, she hooked her hand through my left elbow as if I was escorting her somewhere and said, "Let's go, darling." In an instant, I felt like I had grown 5 inches taller. Here I was, a lowly freshman and former homeschooler, and this attractive senior girl had seen fit to bestow her attention upon me. Not only that, but our bodies were touching. She had looked at me and thought, "Hey, I'd like to grab that boy's arm and hold on to it." She wanted to be seen walking down the stairs with me, arm in arm. It was like a dream, that moment. In the next instant, however, I foresaw how poorly this would turn out. Obviously, she had never seen me walk downstairs, which I managed by holding onto the handrail with one hand and gripping my books under my arm with the other. I would then bend my right knee, descending first with my artificial foot, which would land stiff-legged 2 steps below, and support my body weight while I brought my real foot down beside it. I would repeat this process 2 steps at a time, stepping all the way down the staircase. Anyway, it worked all right as a means of descent, but it was not smooth enough for me to keep my balance while a pretty girl held on to one of my arms. But as we started to walk down the stairs together, I was too mortified to say anything. She had made this wonderfully kind and ego-inflating gesture, and as her reward, she was going to trip the disabled guy. She held on for the first awkward step as I placed my artificial leg 2 levels down. Then I lowered the rest of my body to that stair in 1 quick motion, hers jerking along with me. She ripped her hand back like my arm had turned into a hot stove. We walked the rest of the way down in silence. I kept my gaze on the stairs, focusing on keeping my balance. We parted without a word at the base of the stairs, and after that, we never spoke again. I don't mean to make it sound like she was a jerk. The feeling was mutual. Shame. Shame and embarrassment on my part. Shame and guilt on hers. That moment in the stairwell may have set a world record for the shortest romantic relationship of all time. And after our breakup, there was just too much baggage between us to be able to acknowledge each other anymore. I could not let that happen to Evelyn and me. I would walk down smoothly, and most importantly, I would not fall. As I neared the front of the line, I forgot all about the prom king race. My fear was concentrated on those 6 steps. I was next. As I limped across the stage into the bright lights, I heard the vice principal read our names. Evelyn made it to the center a moment before I did and waited for me. We joined arms, her forearm linked under my left elbow. The audience applauded politely. We strode to the front of the stage, and I stopped where it ended, dropping off into the dark abyss that was the portable staircase. The auditorium went silent while the vice principal waited for us to clear the stage so he could read the next pair of names. Someone coughed. I wished that we had practiced this ahead of time, or at least discussed it. I could have given her some pointers, lowered her expectations a bit, or suggested we forgo the arm holding altogether, which would have made it easier for me to balance. But I couldn't very well let go of her arm now, not with all these people watching and her being unprepared for it. I made a single tentative movement, placing the heel of my artificial leg on the top step. The steps were narrow, not wide enough to fit the length of an entire foot, artificial or otherwise. Thus, I had to balance solely on the heel of my prosthetic foot. As I moved the rest of my body down to that level, Evelyn stepped with me, then paused while I planted my prosthesis on the next step. Once my balance was set, we moved down together. The spotlights on stage still lit up our faces, but our feet and knees were enshrouded in darkness. Without a handrail, the middle steps of a six-step staircase are the scariest section, because you have departed the safe nest of the wide, flat stage, but you aren't yet in the warm embrace of the auditorium floor either. In other words, if you lose your balance, you're gonna tumble. But I was careful, and Evelyn never retracted her hand, even when it was clear that I was having great difficulty, even though 1,000 people were watching us struggle. She held on through all of it, until the next names had been called and we were finding our seats in the mercifully anonymous darkness. Unfortunately, it wasn't long until I heard Vice Principal Harry McGuire say, "Will the following nominees come to the stage?" I felt a shot of adrenaline. Evelyn whispered in my ear, "Good luck." When Mr. McGuire got to my name, I walked down the center aisle, but instead of going up that precariously handrail-less stairway in the middle, I veered to the left so I could use the one on the wing, which had a nice, stable rail bolted into the brick wall. I listened to the way the audience clapped after my name. Were they clapping louder for me than for the other three guys, all of whose names had already been called? I told myself that they were. The four of us lined up in alphabetical order. Trevor Bonneau, Joseph Chuck, John Heinrich, and me. These three guys were not only on the football team, they were the football team. In other words, they were the guys you'd expect to be on this stage right now. They were the popular guys, the ones with cars from this decade. "Ladies and gentlemen, your prom court," Mr. McGuire said after the girls were on stage too. Then, two girls came out from backstage, each holding a crown sitting on top of a red satin pillow. The girls were both freshmen, and they were dressed in almost matching gowns. They reminded me of the flower girls at a wedding. I glanced once more at my three competitors. It occurred to me that perhaps it wasn't so bad that they were more popular than me. In fact, that they all ran in the same social circles could be to my advantage. The three of them would, in effect, split the quote-unquote popular vote. And that would leave me as the only possible candidate for everyone else to vote for. I was the nominee of the commoners, the voice of the people. All those cynics who hated the popular crowd, all those who were disengaged from the social politics of high school but whose name I had always remembered when we passed in the hall, all those would be my votes. And this year's prom king is... I was the populist hero of the huddled masses, the forgotten majority, the underappreciated poor in spirit and the less than popular. They would flock to me. They would vote for me. I would be their king. Joseph Chuck. The audience burst into applause. I dumbly followed suit. With regal grace, Joseph inclined his head so the flower girl could place upon it the majestic crown, bejeweled as it was with hard plastic gemstones. That was my crown. I was supposed to be the one wearing it. Joe waved to the crowd, acknowledging the adoration of his faithful subjects. I was supposed to win prom king, to have the confidence to dance, to confess my feelings to Evelyn. This was my prom. It was supposed to be perfect. For me. As I walked back up the aisle to sit beside Evelyn, I didn't make eye contact with anyone in the audience. These people had seen me lose. They had chosen not to vote for me. And now they sat there all smug, watching my walk of shame. Don't worry about it, Evelyn whispered as I sat back down. It's just a stupid popularity contest. Chapter 22. The night was already over. It was a non-starter, a failure to launch. I might as well drive home right now, I thought. But I couldn't abandon Evelyn. She held on to me when we walked down those stairs. I could stick with her for one night of shame and humiliation. We walked into the open section of the cafeteria that had been converted into a dance floor for prom. There were a lot of decorations, and it was clear that substantial thought and time had gone into making sure they fit together as part of some overall theme. It was hard to say what the theme was exactly, but it apparently had something to do with fairy tales, castles, and large cardboard stars with glitter on them. The room was already packed with several hundred people, and on one side the DJ had set up shop with several towers of speakers, blinking lights, and yes, a disco ball. I was pleased to find the DJ had just started a slow dance. Fast dances are hard. There's a lot of moving, and all this moving requires either skill, the ability to fake skill, or the ability to not care what people think about your lack of skill. I lacked all these traits. Slow dances, on the other hand, were simple. You just put your hands on the girl's waist and then spun around in circles until the music stopped. No skill required. That said, slow dances tend to be hard in, shall we say, another area. It's no secret that girls usually find it weird or even gross when they feel this activity in a boy's body while dancing with him. And as a teenage guy, this is frustrating, because it's not as if we have a choice in the matter. But there are things you can do, like math. While we spun in our slow, tight circle, I did multiplication tables in my head. 6 times 7 is 42. 6 times 8 is 48. 6 times 9. Anything to keep my mind off the fact that my body was in very, very close proximity to that of a female. When you see teenage couples slow dancing, usually you'll notice that the boy is holding the girl at arm's length, keeping an awkward distance between them. Girls often assume this is because the boy feels uncomfortable or self-conscious about dancing. Maybe. But I would suggest that if you look more closely, you may discover it's not the dancing he feels self-conscious about. Anyway, the song ended and people clapped, as they always weirdly do at the end of slow songs, as if applauding their own ability to stand in one place and spin around for 3 minutes without getting dizzy. The music veered to hip-hop, which meant fast dancing. Evelyn and I took a step back from each other, and then I took another one, so we were starting to blend into the circle of acquaintances that occupied this region of the dance floor. Then I started to dance. I transferred my weight back and forth between my real leg and my fake leg, simultaneously making a motion with my arms like I was pedaling a hand-powered bicycle. Pretty hip. Soon enough, the group became an actual circle, like we were playing a standing version of Ring Around the Rosie. Except we weren't. Instead, we were just making awkward eye contact with each other while pretending we were having a good time, pretending we felt comfortable dancing. That's normal fast dancing for you. Everyone stands around and tries to let the music infect them like a virus, one whose primary symptom is rhythmic convulsions and muscle spasms. There's another kind of fast dancing, though, what I refer to as close fast dancing, or CFD. CFD, unlike its more lustful and notorious cousin, grinding, is more fun than sexual. It's basically where a couple assumes a slow dance position, but sways and spins at the speed of a fast dance. It's like ballroom dancing minus the skill, elegance, and rhythm. Sometimes people say grinding when they mean CFD, because said people have not seen what grinding really looks like. How can you tell the difference? It's in the name, people. When you see a couple grinding, there is simply no other word to describe it. They are grinding. When you see a couple holding each other and bouncing back and forth, probably smiling, they are engaging in CFD. The other way to tell the difference is in the axis or plane of motion. When grinding, a couple is moving their hips toward and away from each other, a forward and backward squeezing motion on the y-axis. When CFDing, by contrast, a couple is moving their hips left and right, a side-to-side swinging motion on the x-axis. Got it? Anyway, CFDing still requires a degree of confidence because you must intentionally put your arms around her waist. There is no question about whether she reciprocates. She either starts dancing with you or shrinks away and slips into a protective enclave of her girlfriends, who will then form an impenetrable circular fortress around her and give you mean looks until you back off. So the risk of public rejection is very high. Evelyn and I danced in the open circle for a few songs, me thinking the whole time how I should try to CFD with her. Suddenly, she started walking across the circle toward me. Had she been having the same thought? Was she coming to CFD with me? She grabbed my shoulders and pulled me toward her. This is it, I thought. We are going to do it. I need a rest, she said in my ear. Oh yeah, arthritis. I nodded my understanding. Then I wondered, am I supposed to accompany her? Is that what a prom date does? I wasn't sure, so I asked. Do you want me to go with you? No, Rachel is coming. Was I still supposed to go with her? I wasn't sure. But having a disability of my own, I knew there was nothing more cringe-inducing than the feeling that someone else is giving up an activity you can't do just so you don't feel left out. A disability is already such a burden on you personally. It only gets worse when it's a burden on other people, too. All right, I'll just keep dancing. Come back out when you're ready, I said. Truthfully, I was looking for an excuse to stop dancing. I didn't much enjoy it, but I had talked myself out of following Evelyn for fear she was trying to get away from me. She made a face I couldn't read. She nodded at her friend, and the two of them peeled off from the circle and headed for the snack area. The tables were overflowing with shiny confetti that was getting tracked back on the dance floor on the smooth leather soles of dress shoes. I danced then by myself in the circle of acquaintances. I felt uncoordinated and self-conscious, like everyone was looking at me and laughing inside. Since my prosthesis was attached at the hip, I was essentially sitting on it with the bones of my pelvis, the socket cinched around my waist like a plaster corset. The leg itself, with its three stiff titanium and aluminum joints, was engineered for stability, not for getting down. I felt like I was trying to dance while tied in a seated position to a cement block. I wondered if perhaps prom could still be salvaged. Maybe I could summon some dormant courage and become a fun dancer, the kind of guy who CFDs with his gorgeous prom date. The kind of guy who ignores his recent electoral defeat, who ignores his peers who did not vote for him, and instead focuses on Evelyn. And if I could do that, maybe later we would sit at one of those confetti-sprinkled tables, and I would hold her hand and wonder aloud if maybe there wasn't something more than friendship between us.
The circle collapsed on itself as a few couples paired off to CFD. A few songs later, the DJ brought it back to the old school, his words, not mine, with some early 90s hip-hop. A much larger circle opened up in the center of the room as a guy named Jerome spun around on the floor, pivoting over his hands, swinging his lower body in gymnast-like ways. I felt a poke in my side. It was Evelyn. She smiled at me. People started chanting Jerome's name. Jerome! 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 And he brought the spectacle to a climactic finale, freezing in a handstand and then scissoring his legs into a brief spin on his head. Jerome bowed and people applauded like the best slow dance ever had just concluded. There was an expectant pause. The empty circle held its space while everyone hoped that someone else, that is, another person besides themselves, would jump into the middle and provide additional entertainment. Eventually, someone did. Me. Chapter 23. My artificial leg had three joints: ankle, knee, and hip. That's one reason why it's tough to walk with a hip disarticulation prosthesis, and why so few amputees who lose their leg at that level, that is, amputees who have no residual limb or stump, choose to wear a fake leg. Let me break it down for you. My ankle didn't move the way a normal ankle would. It was only capable of rotation, not flexion, like the motion you would need for a golf swing. My knee moved more like a real one in the sense that it could swing on the plane of motion you would expect from a human knee. To take a step, I would place the fake leg in front of me and then roll across the foot, the knee being designed to bend when my weight hit the toes. This weight-induced bend in the knee would store energy in a pressurized hydraulic piston, which would then push back like a spring, propelling the knee back to a straight position and swinging the prosthesis into a forward step. That's how I walked. There was also my hip joint, which I typically engaged only to move into a sitting position. But the hip joint also provided my favorite feature of the prosthesis, which was its ability to extend far beyond the range of a normal human hip. Translation, I could easily do a split. Even better, I could do a split while standing up. I would balance on my real leg, lifting my artificial one with my hand and pulling it straight up until the foot pointed backward behind my head. This particular party trick I employed in the dance cipher. Footnote, cipher is the technical name for a circle of spectators formed around a breakdancer. Good to know, right? Anyway, I jumped into the middle of the cipher, picking up my prosthesis by the ankle and hopping in a tight spin, waving the fake foot in between two positions, one where I held the straight leg out in front of me, the foot at eye level, and one where it was fully extended in an unnatural standing split with my heel touching my ear. It was no secret that I was an amputee, which I suppose was fortunate because otherwise this would have looked super creepy, like I was some kind of manic yogi ballerina. As it was, everyone was in on the joke, and as I hopped around the circle, they cheered and, yes, even chanted my name. For the record, they had not chanted Joseph Chuck's name when he was crowned prom king. Take that, popularity contests. Obviously, there could not have been a better moment to try to CFD with Evelyn. The circle closed, and I danced my way over to Evelyn. I got really close to her, but I stood so our bodies were facing each other at a 90-degree angle. I figured this would feel less threatening to her than approaching her from straight on. Oh, she would think, Josh is standing really close to me, but our bodies are facing perpendicular directions, so I guess I'm comfortable with this. She glanced at my face, and I smiled at her. She smiled back. I kept hand cycling. Then she rotated her body away from me and took a small but discernible step to create space between us. Classic fast dancing conundrum. Was she trying to get away from me, or had her attention been drawn to the sparkly disco ball? So I danced the rest of that song wondering about this. Are you having fun? She asked. Yeah, I said, which was sort of a lie. I mean, I wasn't not having fun, so maybe there was some basic fun here that I was having without noticing, and I would look back later and think how fun it was in retrospect. The past has a way of turning up the fun volume in your memories. Great, she said, putting a hand on my shoulder, and for the briefest instant, I thought we were about to CFD. I gotta go tell Rachel something. This was twice now that she had put me off. Was she doing it on purpose? I couldn't be sure. I wanted to just give up, to quit trying to CFD with her and spend the rest of the night floating around not caring. But that was the problem. I did care. I cared a lot about her, about us. And we were both going to college in just a few months, and after that I wouldn't be seeing much of her. So what did I have to lose? I mean, besides my pride and dignity. Tonight was probably my last chance with Evelyn. Who knew when she would get back together with Mason, when she would disappear completely from my life? Yes, tonight. Tonight was the night. So I followed her over to her gossip session with Rachel, and when she leaned away and smiled at me, I leaned in and, yes, must reach out, almost there, just a little farther, and put a hand, ever so gently, on her hip. Hey, I said. She smiled and made a quick glance down at my hand. It was very brief, and I supposed she hoped I didn't see it. But I did. What I couldn't see, unfortunately, was how she felt about it. Hey, she answered. I started to sort of bop back and forth like people do when they are dancing. She smiled a tight, toothless smile. She held up a finger. Hold on, just a second. I'll be right back. My hand was left holding air as her body rotated away from me so she could return her mouth to Rachel's ear. I saw Rachel steal a brief look at me and nod. Were they talking about me? Was Evelyn telling her she wanted to get away from me, that she was uncomfortable with my advances? Yes, probably. This was a mistake. All of it. Prom, dancing, Evelyn. All a giant, soul-crushing mistake. This guy Alberto, who I knew, and who I guess knew Evelyn somehow, came up from behind her and started grinding on her. She took a quick look over her shoulder to see who it was. Upon seeing Alberto, she burst out laughing, like he was the funniest guy she'd ever seen, and what a hilarious joke this was that he was dancing with her like this. She pumped her hands in the air, raising the roof, smiling. He put a hand on her hip. She laughed again. If Evelyn had been my girlfriend, I would have said something witty and manly to Alberto. You know, like, get your own date, and then clocked him in the jaw. But Evelyn wasn't my girlfriend, so her heart was not mine to defend. The song ended, and Alberto hugged her and then walked away in search of some other guy whose night he could ruin by dancing with his date. I didn't recover after that. In terms of trying to CFD with Evelyn, I mean. I had tried 3 times, which was more than enough. She didn't care about me. Our friendship? What a joke. We weren't friends. She was just a hot girl I had a crush on. Would I have been friends with her if I didn't have that crush? Probably not. Would she have been friends with me? Again, probably not. She was just using me for the attention. She had that female intuition or whatever that told her that I liked her, and she was just keeping me around because it felt good to have a boy pining for her, bringing her to his prom and listening to her talk about her boy problems. What a mistake all this had been. What a joke. After the dance, we went to after prom, which was held in the recreation center at James Madison University. Everyone brought duffel bags with normal clothes and changed out of their formal wear in the locker rooms. Evelyn was tired, and her knees hurt. She mostly sat with Rachel, both of them in their sweats, both of them encouraging their dates to go have fun, don't worry about us. So that's what I did. I had fun. Or at least I tried to. I sang karaoke, and I played poker with Monopoly money. I jumped in a big inflatable thing. I drank tons of soda. The after-prom party went till nearly sunrise. Then we all went over to this guy John's house. His mom had a breakfast spread for us. We ate and went to the basement to watch a movie. Evelyn found a guest room and went to sleep. When people started leaving, I woke her up and drove her home. I had fun, she said when I was dropping her off. Yeah, I said. Thanks for coming. I did not say I had fun, because I hadn't. Not really. I didn't call Evelyn much after that. I graduated. Summer came. It got hot. Then it was fall, and we both went off to be college students. She ended up not going to the same school as Mason, but she was dating him again. Or so I had heard. Hypothesis. Based on subjects' lack of interest in enacting the cultural mating ritual of close fast dancing, I assume she did not have romantic interest in me. Further investigation is required to determine why subject demonstrated perplexing emotional distance at prom despite deep platonic friendship. Investigation. Chapter 24. Evelyn looked exactly the same as she did in high school. We were having lunch at a sandwich place in Harrisonburg a few days after Christmas. Lunch, because it is the most decidedly unromantic, non-date-like social encounter two people can have. And all this because, well, Evelyn was now married. To that on-again, off-again boyfriend she'd had during high school, Mason. I guess they'd worked everything out and decided to stay on again forever. Anyway, I'd not seen her for years, but as I said, she looked the same. Which is not to say things felt the same. When you have a crush on someone who has a boyfriend, it's a little weird. You convince yourself she may come to her senses and start dating you instead. Even engaged people have been known, mostly in movies, to make a game-time decision to leave the altar and run away with the person they were supposed to be with. But once that girl you had a crush on is married, it's time to admit defeat. She chose forever without you. So the dynamic was different between Evelyn and me. There was a palpable gap between us, a gravity that kept pulling us back toward the emotional safe ground of small talk. But I knew I had to push through. I had come to this lunch to figure out why it didn't work out between us and why, after we had been best friends for so long, she was so disappointingly distant at prom. And I was not going to let the sanctity of marriage stop me from getting my answers. I saw my opportunity at one point while we were reminiscing about old times. Remember when we went to prom together? I tried to say it like, ha ha, wasn't that funny, like these other funny things we've been talking about. But there was still a shift in my tone. Her face said she noticed it. Yeah, senior year? I nodded. That was fun. A lot of fun. I bit my lip. But what? I don't know. I just felt like things were kind of awkward that night. I paused, choosing my words carefully. Like you were sort of, like it just felt weird. Yeah, you're right. That was because I had such a big crush on you, she said, taking a casual sip of water. If I had been taking a sip of my own water in that moment, I'm sure I would have spit it all over the table, blowing it out at high pressure in all directions. What? I had heard her the first time, but there was no way. I must have misunderstood. I said that was because I had such a big crush on you. You did? I was still in disbelief. Yeah, she said, like she was saying, duh. You had a crush on me? Of course. No, not of course. You always had a boyfriend. Not always, she said. Anyway, you really didn't know I liked you? No. She shrugged. I always thought you knew. Nope. Well, surprise. She shrugged again. She was married. She had found her Prince Charming. This was old news to her. So, why didn't you want to dance with me at prom? I was nervous around you. That kind of thing. I shook my head. I had been so worried about winning prom king to impress her. So she would like me. But she already did like me. The whole time, from the beginning. I'm sorry, this is just kind of crazy to hear, I said. It's funny that you never knew. Yeah, hilarious, I said sarcastically. Not ha-ha funny, just interesting funny, she said. I mean, I always used to wonder, you know, what it would be like if we were together. Why didn't you tell me? I did. False. Well, I always asked you to call me. And you asked your boyfriend to date you. Seriously, you guys were together most of high school. Sometimes we were broken up, and those were the times. The times what? When I was waiting for you to ask me out. I sighed and rubbed my chin in my hand. You're right, I said. About? I chuckled. It is funny. I just had no idea. She shrugged again. Well, now you know. Now I know. We ate some more and talked about some more old times, but there was an even bigger gap between us now, because I couldn't stop thinking about this new information. Evelyn had liked me. The whole time, she had liked me. Or at least some of the time, including the time we went to prom. It was as if I had just discovered an old lottery ticket at the bottom of a sock drawer, a scratch-off that was a big winner, but the ticket had an expiration date that had passed years ago. Lily Moore. Background. Chapter 25. One of the first things I learned at college was how difficult it is to get into a fraternity party if you don't have a membership at that fraternity, a membership at another, or boobs, preferably a pair, with minimal fabric standing in between them and the eyes of the guy working the door. That we lacked any of those prerequisites was why my new friend Brad and I found ourselves trying to slip in through a basement window we had managed to pry open several inches. Fortunately, we were both relatively skinny. Why was I so desperate to get into the party? For years, it had been my goal to find a girlfriend. When I went to college, I added to that list of objectives finding a close group of friends. A crew, if you will, who could, among other things, help me navigate the world of dating. Tony, my childhood friend from church, and I had not stayed as close during high school, so I had never had anyone to give me advice when I was trying to date Francesca and Evelyn. That's why Brad and I found ourselves shoving our bodies through that basement window. We thought we might meet some girls at the party. Maybe I could CFD with one of them. But even if we failed on those counts, nothing bonds two people together like a little breaking and entering. So either way, I would end up with a closer friend as a result of the adventure. We dropped from the window into the corner of a room about 5 feet from a makeshift bar, several kegs behind it. No one said anything or even looked twice at us. At a party like this one, I realized, there was a high ratio of people who were there to have fun versus people